Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on managing recurring payments. Accepting and managing recurring payments can be a difficult area for collection agencies. Staying on top of the compliance requirements has prevented some agencies from accepting recurring payments at all, despite the benefits that they can bring to a business. This webinar is being generously sponsored by PDC Flow. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know profile, as well as hosts webinars and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. She is responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario Systems products, and leading the company's compliance consulting services and compliance outsourcing programs. Her 2 decades of experience in the ARM industry make her one of the most respected experts in this industry. Robert Blair is a Senior Vice President of Contact Strategy and Dialing Systems and has been with Diversified Consultants since 2009. As is the case with most of the management at DCI, he started as a collector and has worked his way up the executive level over the past 9 years. He is responsible for all of DCI's contact strategy and dialing operations to ensure the company is efficient, profitable, and competitive on the scorecard for all of the clients for client portfolios DCI services. Julie Hughes is a senior product manager at TrueAccord. She works across teams to launch strategic product updates while maintaining a high level of compliance. During her time at TrueAccord, she has worked on many aspects of the product, from building enterprise integrations to managing payment processes. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question or Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Before we launch into the discussion, I want to read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to assure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker, not his or her organization. Finally, this webinar is being recorded, and a copy of the recording will be made available on AccountsRecovery.net in the coming days. With that, let's begin today's discussion. And let's start, Roseanne, and ask you to give you the honor of the first question. Maybe we should start by discussing the differences between pre-authorized electronic funds transfers and recurring credit card payments.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you everyone for joining this afternoon. Great question, because sometimes there is confusion in the marketplace between pre-authorized electronic funds transfers and credit card payments. And the reason it's significant is because pre-authorized electronic funds transfers are subject to the, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, or EFTA. If you're taking notes, pre-authorized electronic funds transfers are subject to the EFTA and Reg E, period. If you're talking about managing and handling credit card payments, credit cards, though they are an electronic form of payment, they themselves are not subject to the Electronic Funds Transfer Act or Reg E because we are not transferring funds. We are really helping, I guess we could, forgive me for using this, saying it this way, but we're helping the consumer borrow more money from on their Discover card, their American Express, their Visa, whatever, because a credit card really is a, I'll call it a temporary loan of money until the bill comes. And so whereas an electronic funds transfer is a system whereby you literally are moving money out of the consumer's asset account, typically a checking account or a bank account, and moving it to your account. So just thought people should understand that separation. Both are electronic payments, but both are not electronic funds transfers.
I'll also add this. This is Julia Hughes from TrueAccord. Credit card payments are guided by PCI compliance rules, whereas what Roseanne was saying, electronic fund transfers fall under Reg E. Reg E has various guidelines of how to treat those funds or those transfers. Those include when and how you obtain authorization for those recurring payments, how and when to process them, and there's some additional documentation requirements when you're tracking consumer consent, as well as how you're providing receipts to consumers.
Thanks, Julia. Great points. And for some people, this reminds me of the fact that they sometimes are confused about the fact that because of the processor they are using for either the credit card or the debit card payment, they ask, because let's say the debit card may be processed as a credit card behind the scenes. And for purposes of this discussion and mastering compliance as it impacts these two forms of payment, disregard how payments are processed behind the scene with respect to the credit card versus debit processing, but do not disregard that when you think about what account the consumer is providing you with consent to access, if you will. There is a safe harbor, however. The good news is with regard to compliance, and we're going to jump into that very quickly, with regard to compliance, if the consumer tells you this is a debit card, and in fact it's a credit card, or vice versa, they tell you, oh no, it's a credit card instead of a debit card, you technically have a safe harbor protection against failing to meet the appropriate compliance requirements. Now, as a practical matter. Most of us are using systems that will identify whether the payment is debit or credit, but nonetheless, there is a safe harbor in the law. Thanks.
Excellent. And you teed that up nicely, Roseanne. So let's move on and talk about the compliance questions that a collection agency should be asking or the compliance requirements that need to be met by an accepting recurring payment.
All right. I can jump into that if you'd like. The compliance questions relating to the pre-authorized electronic funds transfer, the answers can be found in the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, Reg E, eSign, which is the Electronic Signatures and Global Commerce Act, and the CFPB's November 2015 Guidance Bulletin on pre-authorized electronic funds transfer requirements. So at a high level, when you're talking to a, when your customer service representative, your collector is on the phone with the consumer, they do have to address a number of data points that we'll talk about how you evidence those or document those, recording versus paper, et cetera. But right for purposes of understanding what you need to ask the consumer to confirm, you have to have them identify their name, the bank, and the either the debit card number or the bank account number from which funds are going to be taken. If you're using just the bank account number, you would also need the bank routing number. You also need to provide the consumer with the date of each the pre-authorized electronic funds transfer, the date that the transaction will take place, as well as the amount. If the date or the amount ever changes materially in terms of the payment series for a pre-authorized electronic funds transfer series, if any one of the dates or the amount that you will transfer, you must provide the consumer with at least 10 days notice of that change in the amount that you will transfer or that change in the date of the transfer. As an aside, for any of you who are student loan collectors, be aware of the CFPB's particular concern about calculating interest when the payment date was agreed upon as Friday of this week, but for whatever, or let's say Monday as a bank holiday. Let's pretend Monday is a bank holiday, and the payment should normally have been transferred on Monday, but you don't really get to it until Tuesday. Let's just say it's delayed one day. The CFPB is not does not look kindly upon the fact that you may continue to calculate interest until the actual transaction goes through. So that's just a little bit of an aside. We're not going to go into that in great detail. So after you have the name and the bank account or the debit card number, and you've identified the date of each payment, the amount of each payment, and you recognize that you have a duty to notify the consumer of any major changes in that, you have to let them know what your normal business hours so they can call you in case they need to change the terms or revoke the authorization to transfer sums pursuant to a pre-authorized electronic funds payment arrangement. And finally, not only do you have to let them know how to revoke, you also need to let them know if you have any restrictions on the timing of revocation. And you have two options. One is what everybody uses. You basically can provide the consumer with this option, which is we require at least three business days notice of your intent to revoke or of your revocation of the arrangement, and you can provide that orally, but you can place a limit on the number of days that the consumer has to revoke the payment series or a payment in the series. And the reason that's important is because if somebody calls you 2 hours before your batch process triggers, it's virtually impossible. We'll talk about exceptions, but it's virtually impossible to catch that payment and stop it in time. So the law allows you at least 3 business days. Alternatively, you can say that after receiving the verbal notice of cancellation of the arrangement, you can say that you require the consumer to follow up with written cancellation within 14 days of the oral, but it gets too complicated for you, and it gets way too complicated for the consumer, so I'm not a big fan, and that's not legal advice. So that's an overview of what the compliance questions need to address when you are accepting recurring payments and communicating with a consumer.
That is comprehensive as always, Roseanne. Robert, Julie, anything else you want to add to that before we move on?
Sure, as Julie. I'll add that at TrueAccord, more than 90% of our payment arrangements are made online. We do focus on giving consumers what they want while obviously staying very compliant. We've been able to automate the majority of our compliance checks and the things that we're asking consumers since it is done online, and that removes a lot of the room for error that can sometimes happen when agents are involved. Of course, we do have agents taking payments over the phone, but we're able to really stay highly compliant by using online systems and a lot of automation.
Yeah, and here at this is Robert, by the way. Thank you so much for having me. At DCI, we have the online portal as well, which helps keep us compliant, as Julie said. But we also have a payment, option by phone where they can, tap into an IVR and make a payment, at any time, whether we're open or whether we're closed. And that's another tool that we use to make sure that, we're giving all the revocation statements, we're giving all the necessary statements, without. Not only are we not tying up a resource by having the agent actually handle it, but as Julie said, we're 100% compliant because the script is followed to a T because we wrote it and there's no human element involved.
Mike, just as a caveat to what Robert said, not that it matters to anyone really, but I am a huge fan of that IVR solution or the solution. Julie went through the online payment solution for a number of reasons that we'll get into, not the least of which is that it's a great way to address Reg E and e-sign requirements, but it's such a consumer-friendly way. I'm a huge fan of both solutions as opposed to just over the phone.
Yeah, we also do use IVR at TrueAccord as well, and it has been a really great experience for our customers.
Excellent. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion for a moment to say a few words about the sponsor of today's webinar, PDC Flow. PDC Flow has been a leader in payment compliance within the accounts receivable industry for the past 14 years. With PDC Flow's full suite of payment management products, you can increase revenue while decreasing the man hours spent on processing the payments your business brings in. Accept credit card and ACH payments from customers through an online mobile optimized payment portal, IVR system, or cashier payment screen. Or send the payment request straight to the consumer through text or email instead of sending the consumer to make a payment. With their patent-pending eSign Plus payments, an agency or accounts receivable department can obtain a wet signature on any payment to ensure Regulation E and NACHA compliance. One client of PDC Flow is manually setting up recurring schedules and sending authorizations through snail mail to meet Reg E. They found that by using eSign Plus payments, they were able to automate notifications and receipts and save 14 man hours per week. On top of this, they were able to win 2 chargebacks in court with the e-signature audit report, keeping their merchant account open and in good standing. PDC Flow's payment management system keeps your business efficient, compliant, and profitable with one click. I want to thank Don and Hannah and the team at PDC Flow for sponsoring today's event. Now, let's pick up our discussion. So we've talked a bit about the benefits of recurring payments, and you know, they're pretty easy to spot. Let's look at the flip side. Julie, are there pitfalls to accepting payments on a recurring basis?
Yeah, definitely. One of them is that sometimes people will set up a recurring payment plan and then they'll forget about it. Usually that's a good thing because then we can just take out those payments on a weekly, biweekly, monthly basis, etc. But sometimes people can forget about that payment if it's, you know, a month from now and they don't really budget for that expense. So those future transactions can sometimes be declined due to not sufficient funds in their accounts. But at TrueAccord, we've really done a lot of work to align when people are making those payments to when they have money in their accounts. For example, one thing we introduced recently was a concept called pay on payday. So we're actually asking people when they get paid and if they want to align those recurring payments to those paydays. If it does happen where people aren't able to make that payment because it fails, we do have automated emails that remind people to get back on those plans and update their payment information. Another pitfall is that cards can expire over the course of the payment plan. So you know, if you're setting up a one-year plan, maybe your card expires in 6 months, and that's not something the consumer is necessarily thinking about at that time. So then they have to re-log into the portal or call up our support team and update their payment information. The last one I'll mention is that we have to be very careful about managing return rates. And that's really why we give people the easiest ways possible to tell us when they can't make an upcoming payment. People can log into our online portal to change their payday. They can call or email our support team. And I'll mention that 75% of our traffic is mobile. And so they can really just pick up their phone and send us an email or call us and make sure that they are able to change that recurring payment if they're not able to make it.
And those are great points, Julie. And to kind of add to what you said about setting up the reoccurring payments, through agents specifically, we at Diversify Consultants, we've always kind of preached the payday. It's in our script. You know, when is your next payday? And we kind of train our agents to, set those payments up for the paydays and ask if they get direct deposit or do they not. Or do they have to manually put their check in? Because, you know, that's going to make a difference. If you get direct deposit every Friday, then we know that when we batch our cards at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, the money's already there. But if you need to, if you get a paper check, maybe a blue collar job, small businesses, or you have to go to the bank and put your check in your bank account, then, maybe we'll post that payment for a Saturday or something like that. Another kind of pitfall would be a lot of the collection software is kind of defaulted, at least in our case, it's defaulted to a monthly arrangement. And, the bad thing about that is people don't get paid monthly. People get paid biweekly, weekly. It's very rare you get someone, gets paid monthly. So what ends up, happening is, you know, you go to set up a payment, you know, you're an agent, and, you know, today is the 24th, you set the payment up for the 27th. Well, that's all well and good because that's the consumer's payday, the 27th. But if you set up monthly arrangements, then next month that's going to be a Sunday. The following month that's going to be a Wednesday. And you can see how that doesn't necessarily align with the paydays. So what we always preach is, you know, like Julie said, you know, setting them up for the paydays, but then setting them up in such a way if they want to pay once per month, do a every 4 week type of transaction. That way, all of your future payments are going to be dated for a payday. That's a huge pitfall a lot of newer agents get into, setting it up for the 27th of every month. And unfortunately, when you're talking about recovery, the consumers you're dealing with are in collections for a reason. And a lot of the time, you have to get that money before someone else does or before it's spent. So that would kind of be the biggest thing that I would preach as far as pitfalls. Other than the fact of maybe, you know, giving up the balance in full today or the balance in full, you know, maybe their next payday. A lot of the times when you say payment arrangement, a lot of the times people think that, you know, we're going to finance their debt for an extended period of time. And then, you know, you obviously have some compliance concerns when you're talking about is, you know, when is it due? You know, how long do I have to pay? And, you know, that gets kind of murky in some jurisdictions from what I understand. So really and truly, you know, it's great to be able to set up those reoccurring payments. It's absolutely a tool that's necessary in collections. It's just making sure your agents are kind of aware of setting them up, you know, and preventing failure. Another thing that's really helped us is by setting up a PPA team, a team that handles specifically broken arrangements. It's a two-sided, you know, scenario because not only are we having our prime agents focus on recovery of you know, new arrangements, but it also solidifies their credit card clearing ratio because they know if this credit card doesn't go through, then it's going to be, you know, swept to a PPA collector, and then that agent is going to then reap the benefits of their hard work. Potentially, you know, I didn't think about the direct deposit situation. Man, all they have to do is make a call and the arrangement's set back up and you kind of lose that account commission. So it's really helped firm up our clearing ratios by adding that PPA element because the agents know that I have to solidify this arrangement right now because I won't get another chance if this arrangement, you know, breaks.
Great points. I think I'd just like to comment on a couple of the observations Julie and Robert have made. First of all, picking up on training your agents, one way to avoid the basically a payment arrangement becoming obsolete due to the fact that the card expired and it's no longer a valid number is to make sure there's a reason why you're asking, in addition to making sure that you're sending the processor the information they need to process the payment, the expiration date is also something to be mindful of. And your agent should know that if it expires June of 18, it doesn't make sense to set up a 9-month payment plan with that card. So that's just kind of a practical observation that should be, I guess, included in any training. The other thing is if you are a third-party debt collector, there is no reason you cannot engage in and use the pre-authorized electronic funds transfer option for recurring payments. But remember that not only is there that notice that you have to send if the amount or timing of any payment changes, there is also the FDCPA's, we used to refer to it only in the context of a post-dated check, which most people aren't even using anymore in the manner that triggered that requirement, but it does include a duty to remind people of a post-dated payment. So there is built into the FDCPA, you can just double-check the post-dated check section, and I can share it with people if they don't know how to access it, but it's basically not more than 10 days or less than, I think it's
I believe it's four. I mean, it's been a while since I've been on
four.
The phone.
I think I don't think it's four.
I think it's three.
It's three. It's not four. It's like three or ten, but not more than ten nor less than three.
That's probably why I'm thinking of four, less than three.
Well, anyway, so that's an important reminder. And then I think one of you mentioned an aptly so that you do need to send a copy of this agreed upon arrangement to the consumer. And when we say the word send, that is typically suggests U.S. mail. There are ways to send the copy electronically. And when we get into the topic of electronic signatures and Global Commerce Act, we can talk about how you can substitute a digital delivery of a legally required document for a snail mail U.S. Postal Service delivery of that document.
Excellent. So let me ask Julie and Robert, let me ask both of you this, and to the extent that you can share without giving away too much, what percentage of your customers usually agree to recurring payment arrangements?
For us, over 80% of our payments come in from payment plans. We really focus on giving people a lot of options up front. They log into our online portal, see the various payment offers and options that we give, and it usually works in the favor of our customers to pay over time. And when they're signing up for plans online, it's automatically going to be a recurring automatic payment. If customers do want to have the flexibility of, calling our agents or entering in their payment information online manually every month, we can do that. But the majority of our customers prefer to pay via recurring payments.
And so here at Diversify Consultants, I don't have an exact figure as to consumers set up reoccurring payments, but obviously conversion rates aside, the majority of the folks that we speak to that either set up a payment arrangement or a payment in full, the majority of them are set up on a reoccurring payment plan. Depending on the portfolio, we tend to stick with 3 months. We have a hierarchy depending on the portfolio, but for the most part, if we're speaking to a consumer on the outbound side, obviously you're going to get those inbound, say, I just want to pay my bill. But on the outside, I would say it's probably 70 or 80% of those that set up a payment do so with a debit or credit card as a reoccurring payment. We obviously still do the ACH or do the check transfers. However, the amount of payments that we get via check versus debit or credit card is maybe 10% checks, 90% debit or credit card. So the majority of our payments that we're setting up as reoccurring payments are going to be debit or credit card payments.
Yeah, for TrueAccord, the majority of our payments are debit and ACH. A lot of our clients that we work with prefer us to not do a credit card. So a little bit of a different mixture, which is interesting.
Well, yeah, we actually have a few clients that have that kind of similar requirement. They don't want you to kind of finance debt. So for those specific portfolios, it's probably different. But the majority of what we service is telecom debt, and we don't have quite those requirements for 95% of our portfolio. So the majority of our payments are debit or credit card, but I do know in the financial services realm for other places and other colleagues that you're right, it is the complete opposite because of that kind of requirement by the client.
Yep, definitely.
Robert, I think you mentioned something in one of your answers about scripts and trying to get people onto payment plans. Can you talk a little bit about the strategies that DCI's tried or that they have in place to try and either increase the number of individuals who opt to make payments for recurring transactions or to get everybody onto a payment plan?
Well, yeah. So like I said, we do have the hierarchy, right? You know, when we talk to a consumer, you know, we're going for the balance and full today. I mean, that's obviously where you start. And, you know, the majority of the time, at least on the outbound side, you know, no, they don't have the $600 today to pay the bill or the $1,000 or whatever it may be. Otherwise, it probably wouldn't be in collection. So we have a hierarchy kind of depending on the placement period and, you know, the period in which we're scored. You know, some clients kind of have a hard stop where X amount of time is kind of all we get, and then it kind of moves on to the next stage. Whereas we have other clients that, you know, as long as there's a payment being made, you know, we'll kind of allow that to continue and allow us to kind of keep that in our portfolio. But I think the biggest thing is really getting the agent kind of on board with the script that we put together. A lot of the times, especially when you get kind of transplants from other collection agencies or other call centers, you know, they tend to like to, you know, they're stuck in their ways, so to say. So I think the biggest thing is using your quality department, you know, if you have a speech analytics or something like that, to use those tools to make sure that your agents are following the script and the hierarchy that you set. You know, you can strategize all you want. You can put together, you know, spreadsheets and, you know, why is this not working? Why is this working? But if the strategy that you put together isn't being implemented by operations, by the agents on the phone, it really doesn't mean anything. So for us, the biggest thing is when we put together a strategy, regardless of, you know, payments or otherwise, whether it just be the initial done or, you know, making sure the disclosures are given or, you know, following the hierarchy as far as how long we're willing to set these payments up for, really just ensuring the agents are following that script and following the strategies and obviously coming up with a plan of action to attack, you know, the instances where they don't or where they go off on their own or was there a reason why, try to identify why and then kind of put them on the right path so that you don't have, you know, $20 a month for the next, you know, 15 months or, you know, 3 years. Really, that's my biggest thing is just making sure the strategy is being followed by the agents actually talking on the phone.
I'll add at TrueAccord, we also use agents, but the majority of our plans and payments are done online. And a unique thing about our product is that we have a decision-making engine called Heartbeat. And Heartbeat uses various factors such as debt amount, client requirements, et cetera, that determines the kinds of offers that would work best for our consumers. And since we know that payment plans are taken most often, we always provide a lot of flexible options that work for our customers and our clients and us. So the most important thing is that we outperform because we treat our customers the way they want to be treated, and we let them sign up for payment plans that are easily customizable. It removes barriers to sign up for payment plans. They don't have to do a lot of, you know, haggling. And we really create that trust to get people on these recurring transactions. So to summarize, the ease of use of our product plus gaining that trust from our consumers means that we get the majority of our revenue from these recurring payment plans.
Excellent. Roseanne, let me move on and ask you this question. What kind of notifications should be provided before or after a recurring transaction is made?
Well, with regard to, let's start with after. That's where it is necessary that you promptly send a copy of the agreement. All of those data points we went through at the beginning need to be included in that copy, not verbatim. And that includes whether it's made on a website, whether it's the payment arrangement is set up via an IVR or by phone. The Reggie requires that a copy of the written authorization signed or similarly authenticated is another requirement we should probably get into, but be sent to the consumer promptly. And at least one court decision has said that 48 hours is adequate. My personal recommendation is within 24 hours of that, of entering into that pre-authorized electronic funds transfer arrangement. And then you move to, we've talked about the 10-day notice, and we've also talked about the post-dated payment notice as required under the FDCPA. As a, I think if it's all right with you, Mike, I'd really like to make sure that we address why the IVR solution and the website solution work so well. There are a couple of reasons. Number one, well, the, Julie and Robert have explained a number of the reasons, but two other reasons that I've observed would be, number one, you do control or are provided with the opportunity to go through all of the e-signature consent requirements with the consumer. And once you do that, you have magical powers. And if there, if from my standpoint, my I have this quest for 2018 that everybody in our industry understands the following. You can substitute digital communications for written that in the event, let me back up. When you are required to send a document to a consumer as a matter of law, regulation, etc., you may substitute mailing them that document and using a digital form of communication if you comply with the Electronic Signatures in Global Commerce Act. So, for example, here are some a list of legally required documents. A validation notice. Within 5 days of the initial communication, you shall send the consumer, blah, 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 the validation notice. The post-dated payment notice. That's a required notice that it should be sent subject to the FDCPA. So we've already identified two areas of the law which requires the third part, the debt collector, to send something to the consumer. Well, let's say you would like to save on postage and you don't want to use snail mail. You can time me right now in when I first, I'll give you, I'll say start, if you'd like to time this, but this is how you allow, this is the consent you need under the Electronic Signatures and Global Commerce Act to substitute digital exchange of information with the consumer for U.S. Postal Service. So let's start now. I'll just say, Mike Gibb, thank you for visiting with us today. I'm glad we set up a payment arrangement. You are affirmatively consenting to use of email and text, your email address and your text cell number by consenting to this arrangement. You understand you have a right to receive any information we've talked about today or that we may need to send you in the future in paper form at no charge. Mike, you may withdraw consent at any time by simply unchecking a box on the website or calling us at blah, blah, blah number. Please remember you can update your contact information, including your email and cell phone number or any credit card or debit card number as applicable, by simply calling us or visiting our website. There's an update section there. You can receive these documents. We need to confirm that you can receive these documents using, in the case of a text message, let's say, using a current cellular number. So in order for me to be sure that you can, in fact, receive documents from me, Mike, I'd like you to provide me and reconfirm that you can accept text messages by sending me a text now. And then you'll give the consumer a number to send that text for. And that constitutes compliance with the Electronic Signatures and Global Commerce Act. And once the consumer agrees to that, you can now entertain sending the validation notice by email or text. You may now, this does not address security issues. That's a different question. But I really want people to understand, just because I simply give you my email address does not mean you can send me legally required notices that way. You need to go through these extra hoops required by eSign in order to have the right to substitute digital, providing me with information digitally as opposed to by U.S. mail. So once we get past that, then we're good to go.
Excellent. Thank you for that. By the way, I think I thought it was close to between 45 seconds and a minute. That sounds about right.
Okay.
In terms of how long that took, which is not very long considering how much money you're going to save.
Exactly. Right.
So let's move on. What steps, and Robert, I'll ask you, maybe you can go through the steps your agency, the process when initiating a recurring payment arrangement with an individual.
So obviously we, you know, try to get the arrangement that fits best for the consumer. You know, once we come up with the arrangement, you know, obviously it gets a little tricky when you are referring to certain states. You know, there's some states where you can't solicit a post date. So that gets kind of tricky as to what does soliciting actually mean. You know, so we obviously for those states, we only would allow the consumer to set something up that, you know, they're calling in under their own fruition or they're setting it up on their own IVR website, something like that. So our agents are trained not to solicit in those states where they can't solicit. But other than that, essentially what we try to do is set up the arrangement, obviously give the proper disclosures, the revocation, the NACHA, you know, any other statement that's applicable. We make sure that we go over the dates with the consumer to ensure that their dates that are on their paydays. We also make sure that the arrangement will fit within our service schedule, essentially the placement period, and provided that it does, provided the consumer's agreed to everything. We also send out, you know, the NITD letter to kind of remind them the 4 to 10 days between before the payment is set to go out. And then obviously, you know, we give them an opportunity if they need to make changes, they can do that by contacting us. We don't have an option for them to change payment arrangements or you know, make any changes via the IVR, but we do on the website. So we make sure that we give them the website. A lot of the times what we'll tend to see is a lot of people will try to self-service, which in our industry is great. You know, we give them, here are your payment dates. You're going to get the letter reminding you and kind of everything we set up. You're going to get letters before the payment set to come out. You have our phone number. If you need to make any changes, give us a call. You can also go on the website. And, you know, we find a good percentage of consumers go back and kind of, you know, service themselves, whether it's, you know, calling in just to make a payment, just to pay it off. You know, maybe you have 300 times three and you get a lump sum of money. You just want to pay it off. Obviously, you know, we give them that option or just to cancel, or to revoke, you know, via the website. But the biggest thing is just making sure that, you know, like we said before, all of the disclosures are given, making sure the dates, you know, work for them. They're on their paydays. It's an amount they can afford. You know, one of the bigger pitfalls that we'll see, especially with, you know, less seasoned collectors is, you get the, especially in the telecom side, because a lot of the times it's a revolving door between different, you know, telecom, you know, providers. So what we'll find is somebody calling in wanting to set up a payment with a check for Friday for the balance in full. You know, we kind of train our agents to kind of, you know, think twice about that. So we kind of look into that a little bit more. You know, they had the account for 4 months. They paid a total of, you know, $100 on the account. Now they have a $1,000 bill. They want to pay it off with a check tomorrow. So we're cognizant to that. The idea on the consumer side is essentially they clear a check, T-Mobile or whatever the provider may be says, hey, you know, the payment has been made, go ahead and reissue them service. And then the payment reverses. So, just making sure your agents are really cognizant of kind of what they're doing, making sure the disclosures are given, making sure that the dates are something that a consumer agrees upon, and then giving them an easy way to revoke or to change, via the website or via calling in, so that they can restructure the arrangement if they need. A lot of the times when you're talking about recovery, there's a sense of embarrassment factor in some cases. You know, a lot of the times what we'll find is somebody will set up a kind of what we call a pie in the sky, $300 a month and they're on SSI. And, you know, obviously the arrangement fails, and then kind of getting them back on the phone to set them up for an arrangement that actually works for them. Sometimes there's an embarrassment factor there. So we try to get it right on the first time so that we don't have to rework that account. And, you know, making sure we're setting up arrangements that work for us, but also work for the consumer, because there's nothing worse than, you know, counting on that payment at the end of the month and, you know, it declines. Now you have to rework it if you even get them back on the phone.
Yeah, this is Julie to record again. I would definitely reiterate that. I think we've probably all found that forcing people to stay on a payment arrangement that they're not actually able to pay doesn't get you paid. So I think it's really important to offer every way possible for consumers to contact us so that they can change those monthly payments and either push out the dates or change the payment amounts. For us, we allow people to change their payments online, email or call our support team. It's been pretty successful in, you know, working with people on being flexible with what works for them.
A couple of comments from a compliance standpoint is those are typical scenarios where the consumer may need to make a change to the payment arrangement. The legal question for each of you to make is whether you need to send a new copy of that arrangement to the consumer after a change like that. There is a private right of action under the Electronic Funds Transfer Act. So there is a motivation similar to that in the FDCPA and the FCRA and the TCPA, but hear me out. There is a private right of action, so you can be sued for failing to comply with the Electronic Funds Transfer Act and Reg E, as we've discussed. But keep in mind, there's something very interesting in the Act itself about liability, and it's called the make it right defense. So a person will have no liability under this act for any failure to comply with any requirement if before a lawsuit or it has commenced, the person, meaning like you, notifies the consumer about the failure and complies with the requirements, basically takes corrective action appropriate to eliminate the issue in the first instance. So very, very powerful defense under the Electronic Funds Transfer Act that I thought people should be aware of.
Yeah, to touch on that question, we definitely do send updated payment plan information with new schedules, dates, amounts, etc. So we aim to definitely communicate any changes that are made that are requested of us.
That's excellent. Excellent process. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was just about to ask the private right of action question. So thank you for getting to that. Okay. We have a number of questions that have come in, and we're shortly running out of time. So I want to try and get to as many of these as possible. I want to present a scenario to you. It was emailed a couple of days ago to me by somebody, and maybe we can get some insight. We currently use e-signature capability, which has kept our chargeback percentage very low as we process thousands of transactions in any given month. Our recurring transactions are not tokenized, to my understanding. I believe it is an issue with our collection software, not necessarily the credit card processor. We seem to always be denied on our recurring transactions that do not show approved security credentials, such as same address and security code. I know this information is not stored for security reasons, so how can we combat these chargebacks successfully to prove that we did gain an authorization? As I stated earlier, even with our e-signature authorizations, we are denied these recurring transactions. Please help. Does anybody have any insights into this situation?
I can just say at TrueAccord, we use a tokenization service called Spreedly, and that it stores all of the information needed to process each recurring transaction. This obviously improves approval rates, and we have a low chargeback rate. So I would suggest looking into doing that and understanding, you know, what are the current blockers for having a tokenization service. You know, there's definitely like guidance on what documentation that you can provide when you do have chargebacks. And you know, that could be proof of payment, proof of positive AVS, matching address, et cetera. But I would work with your payment processor to see what steps you can take to lower those chargebacks.
And to kind of add to that, Julie, really, I think the best defense for a chargeback is to not have them. I mean, obviously, you're going to have them, right? But, you know, strategically and operationally, kind of doing everything you could possibly do to prevent them. Obviously, you're going to have them. And, you know, what we found is you can have everything in the world and, you know, you win some, you lose some, obviously. But at the end of the day, the banks are going to tend to side with their customers. Obviously, there's, you can get past that if you have the appropriate documentation. But, you know, at least for us at DCI, you know, we're dealing in, you know, high volume. So for us, we try to avoid the chargeback as much as possible by doing kind of everything that we've outlined here. And then when we get them, if we feel that it's something that we can absolutely, you know, fight, we do. But, you know, for the most part, you know, we kind of just, it is what it is. It's kind of the cost of doing business. So for us, I think the biggest thing that you could do is as Julie said, you know, kind of look into the tokenization, but really just try to do everything you can do on the front end to prevent them. And, you know, if you're doing that, then your chargebacks on the back end shouldn't be too significant to really hurt you.
Excellent answers. Let's move on to some of the other questions now that have come in during the discussion. What about Visa branded or MasterCard branded debit cards that can be run as credit card or debit? What about Visa branded HSA healthcare savings cards that are run as credit cards? I guess the question is, how are those handled?
I get it. That's kind of what I was trying to address. And I apologize if that isn't clear. When they are, many of those debit cards are branded under a Visa, MasterCard, you name it. You just pull yours out of your wallet and you'll see it. That is the part you want to disregard. Don't even get, for purposes of complying with, maybe if, unless you're asking a different question, but for purposes of complying with all the legal requirements to accept and process these payments, you only need to determine, is it a debit card, basically allowing you to take funds out of a bank account, or is it a true credit card where at the end of the month you receive a statement and you can pay the balance in full? That's what you need to understand the difference between. So, because if you're setting up a series of recurring credit card payments, you do not need to jump through all the hoops that we've talked about this afternoon. But if you're setting up a series of recurring pre-authorized electronic funds transfers, you do. By the way, I do want to say there's a one-year statute of limitations on the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, but a two-year minimum audit requirement with regard to saving your voice recordings and other documentation, establishing the authorization and signature. So I just wanted to make sure people are aware there are, you do need to address the document retention issue associated with this type of payment.
I'll also add that it's important to not take the debit or credit recommendation from the customer at face value. We use BIN-DB, which is a BIN database that tells us automatically whether it's debit or credit. And that is our source of truth on what type of payment is being entered. And so we use that to understand what our requirements are around these recurring payments.
How are recurring payments impacted by state laws? Are there any state laws that people need to be aware of with respect to recurring payments?
So I'll kind of hop in there. I kind of mentioned earlier, as far as the state laws go with the solicitation of a post-dated payment arrangement, and, you know, I'm absolutely not a compliance expert, so I'll let the compliance expert correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's Massachusetts and Rhode Island where, you know, you can't solicit a post-date. So, you know, what we have our agents do is, you know, they're not soliciting a post-dated payment. If the consumer calls in and would like to make, you know, the payment, they'll take it right then. If they want to set up a post-dated arrangement, what they'll tend to have them do is, you know, offer, you know, our mailing address to mail those in. And if the consumer says, well, can't you just take my card and just run it on the days? And then, you know, we'll go out and set that up because we're not soliciting it. We're offering a mail-in option for them to, you know, take advantage of a mailing in a payment. If they specifically ask and want to give their card and want to set it up for a specific date, we will facilitate that. But those two states are kind of the biggies here at DCI, and there's probably other little caveats. I'm absolutely not a compliance expert, so I just want to say that.
Okay, let's move on. Are there any differences in first-party collection versus bad debt? You mentioned post-payment from the FDCPA. Does that mean the notice requirement isn't applicable in first-party collections?
That's true. I'll take that one, at least initially. The first-party collection model suggests, actually requires, that you are functioning, in fact, you're functioning as a de facto employee of the creditor. So therefore, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act does not apply. And though we're not addressing the model for first-party collections, remember, do not adopt the philosophy that what can it hurt? Let's comply with the FDCPA and any other laws we can find that could possibly keep us out of jail, because all you've really done is blurred your role. Are you a de facto employee or not? But in fact, the Electronic Funds Transfer Act is party neutral. I mean, it's agnostic to whether you are a third party or a first party or the actual creditor when it comes to the Electronic Funds Transfer Act compliance, and the FDCPA does not apply to first party and creditors.
Excellent, thank you. Let's move on here quickly, see if we can get a couple of these done before I get to. Can you address fees? Charging $3 per payment on a payment plan, regardless of payment type, but not charging the fee for a one-time payment?
For TrueAccord, we don't charge any fees, so I'll let somebody else address that if they want to.
Well, I think what I'm teasing you when I say this, but they're kind of baiting us into a convenience fee conversation, or alternatively that surcharge conversation, where some states do, there is this, I think, I don't know how many, if there were 15 or 18 states, allow you to favor, I will say, the cash payment versus a payment that triggers a charge to you in order to process it. So that's a whole separate arena. Convenience fees for the debt collector must be provided. You must find the authorization in one of two areas. Either it's permitted because of the language of the underlying contract between the creditor and the consumer, or it is permitted by law. One of the two have to exist. And be happy to talk about convenience fees at another time, but that's what we're talking about here. And it's a complicated area. Probably wise just not to do it, but you know, really.
Last question. In regards to the cancellation notice, transactions have been denied by merchant services due to the notice not being sent prior to the payment arrangement being taken. Our e-sign authorization notice is only set to be sent after the payment information has already been gathered. Any thoughts? Our arrangements show the payment transaction data already entered from the system to the authorization notice for approval.
I'm trying to figure out if I truly understand the question.
Same.
Transactions have been denied by merchant services due to the notice not being sent prior to the payment being
okay.
taken.
Okay, let's stop there with the question. If that's the issue, go to the November 15th November 2015 CFPB Guidance Bulletin at cfpb.gov or Google CFPB Guidance Bulletin pre-authorized and you'll see it. It's going to pop up. And I think it's on the third page, the top of the page. There's a statement that the CFPB does not require, as a matter of clarification of Reg E requirements, does not require that the copy be sent, much less delivered, before you can process the initial payment in the series. But you must send it promptly, in which the case, that case I mentioned, which I could provide Mike Gibb with if he wants to distribute. But there is a case that says 48 hours. And like I said, I think 24 is why more appropriate. So there is something you could present to that organization to help convince them that you do not have to have that thing sent before they process. Now, if that's not the question, then I would disregard everything I just said. But anyway.
Well, we're going to leave that as the final word. We're going to assume that that was the right answer. And just like everything else that was presented today, was a thorough, comprehensive insight into recurring payments. So before I let everybody go, I want to thank Roseanne, Robert, and Julie for their insights and their time today. This webinar definitely would have been a lot less informative if it had just been me here trying to answer these questions and provide this information. So I want to thank them for taking their time. I also want to thank PDC Flow for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.pdcflow.com to learn more about the company or call 877-732-4814 for more information. Thank you to everybody who participated in today's webinar. Thank you to those who signed up and listened and asked questions. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. And be sure to enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.